All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. If you'd like, you could move up to the front. If not, feel free to stay where you are. My name is Mighty Fine. I am a public health analyst at the American Public Health Association. And today we will have two great presentations from our institute participants. One team is from New Mexico, North America, right? And the other team is from Florida. And just to give you a little background about the institute, APHA, with funding from Colgate-Palmolive, has convened a maternal child health institute since about 2000. And it includes faculty-led presentations, maternal child health scientific track during the annual meeting, and various distance learning opportunities throughout the year. And we actually have one of our faculty members here, Dr. Richard Aronson, who has been involved since the very beginning. And it's just basically a leadership development and training program. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mirny, who will give us a presentation on preparedness in Florida. Right.
Good afternoon. Here we see a pregnant woman stands in a flooded street after Tropical Storm Hanna hit the area of Gonaive, Haiti. That was this September 2008. Three storms killed at least 175 people in less than a three-week period, and even as Tropical Storm Hanna edged away, forecasters warned of a fourth storm, Hurricane Ike, that was destined to also hit the Western Hemisphere's poorest country. My name is Mirny Dye. I'm from Key West, Florida, and I'm representing the Florida team for the APHA Maternal Child Health Leadership Institute. The following photos are going to represent some of the motivation for our leadership project. These are photos that we've collected after various hurricanes and disasters, mostly in the United States, but there's some from the Caribbean and abroad. You'll see these photos weaved throughout our presentation, just to help to illustrate the intensity of the topic that we chose. Here we see a family wading through Katrina floodwaters with their infant carrier. Here's a woman who rests on an embankment near a bridge in the New Orleans area after the Katrina floods. Her infant looks just a few days or maybe a few weeks old. And here we can see families waiting for disaster relief supplies. This photo particularly struck us as it's a child carrying another child. And this was outside of the New Orleans Superdome. You can see in the child's bottle, it's neither milk nor water, probably a mixture of the two. So as an introduction to our project, we identified a target population that we felt was a very vulnerable group when it comes to public health threats and disasters, which is pregnant, lactating women, families with small children. Some background. We feel that every community and hospital should be working with local maternal and child health groups to address childbirth and the care of postpartum women, as well as infants, before, during, and after a disaster. I've noted here that childbirth represents the number one U.S. hospitalization. And taking this into consideration, pregnant women need to be on the top of the list of populations to consider. In our community, in my community in the Florida Keys in South Florida, for example, women are told to report to a hospital if they're more than 36 weeks pregnant to ride out the storm. We don't really consider that a good comprehensive plan, far from it. Lessons that we've learned about our population just in using Katrina as an example included many documented emergency deliveries, and by emergency we mean away from the planned place of birth with someone other than their planned caregiver. Also, numerous separated families, evacuated newborns, and many of them premature, and then more than 1,000 missing children. Subsequent hurricanes have had a similar, although a smaller scale, effect in the United States, but it continues to be a major concern in the Caribbean. One of the items that we referenced and used in our research was a 2007 APHA survey of families that found and noted that many vulnerable subgroups of the general public, as well as key institutions in our society, still lag behind where they should be with regards to preparedness. Here's a few of the key findings. that 61% have some emergency planning. This is referencing families. 46% say that they have enough food or supplies for 3 to 7 days. 3 to 7 days being a low-end recommendation for something like a hurricane, whereas 7 to 2 weeks is more of the recommendation for something like a pandemic threat. 15% approximately have ever considered evacuation and having a plan or a designated meeting place for their families. And additionally, some of the other items that I pulled out of that report was that 29% say they don't have enough food set aside. 29% do acknowledge that. And mothers of young children do not consider themselves well prepared for public health threats. There are a few certain subgroups of the population who are more affected by disaster preparedness and then the appropriate responses. These are often groups who their needs are not going to be fully addressed by the mass scale planning. This would be pregnant women not having the information they need for what to do with themselves during an emergency, and families with young children not being familiar with emergency resources. I'm going to give you some examples of what families did consider as part of their emergency planning later on in the slide presentation. Another key concern should also include preventing poor outcomes in infants. We strongly agree that health workers must be trained in how to protect the health of infants by promoting as well as protecting breastfeeding. The basic message in infant care and feeding is that breastfeeding is the norm, and most often it is the safest form of infant feeding. This provides a protective effect when supplies are few and when disaster relief or response is slow. In another example of, say, a pandemic, the waves of flu, if it's a pandemic influenza, the waves of flu could be quite long. In this photograph, this is a picture taken after the Chinese earthquake of a Chinese police officer. She also herself, a mother of a young infant, found herself in the unique position of providing food to 6 orphaned infants. Unclean water and the lack of artificial infant formula would have certainly meant death or disease for these infants if she would not have been able to assist them. So, when thinking about this issue of preparedness, and at the time of the start of our project, the lack of attention to preparedness with the population that we're addressing, I began to gather a diverse group of cross-section of my colleagues that might also be interested in addressing this topic with me for our Leadership Institute. My first teammate was a colleague and fellow graduate student from Florida International University in Miami, Anna Marie Garces de Marcia, has experience in international maternal and child health, and she's an epidemiologist. Our next team member was actually a Leadership Institute alumni from a previous year, Lena Camperlingo. She's now in the DRPH program and working at the CDC on a sudden unexplained infant death project. Her job was sort of to be our mentor and guide us in our leadership as well as some team building. Our next recruit was Ariana Nesbitt, who's a Key West policy expert with her degree in public service administration, and Lucille Stringer. She's a registered nurse with our Florida Department of Health and oversees many of the children's medical services programs. As for me, my background is a 12-year veteran of outreach, childbirth education, lactation counseling, and midwifery assisting. After we developed our passionate multidisciplinary team, we set out to see just how much could we do in a 1-year project time. Did I mention this was also my master's research project? I graduated this year. And realizing the enormous scale that we had undertaken with this project and finding that we started finding that other groups were beginning to research this as well. One group was such as the White Ribbon Alliance had begun to issue pretty comprehensive topic papers on this. So we sought to do our research and try to bring it all together. while being advocates for it at the same time in both our local communities and in our state. Our basic overview consisted of doing research on the issue, finding out the morbidity and mortality with the population affected, especially with regards to disasters, and then evaluating other resources along the way of how we could apply it to our project. We came up with an outline for a toolkit, which would be both a written document, but we were also interested in producing something tangible that we could use, you know, for distribution. You'll see lastly I listed focus group. Although if I'm to publish this, which I am hoping to do, I'll probably list the focus group results first. The reason it's last in our activities is here is that what came out of part of our learning process with the Leadership Institute was that one of our faculty members, is actually David Intricasso, suggested that we might build a better toolkit if we actually use focus group data as an input, sort of at the beginning. We were already quite a little ways into our project, so we had already begun, so we went ahead and sought the IRB approvals to conduct a focus group and write an instrument. But this did come later on in our project. So in doing our research, we were just overwhelmed by the number of stories and photographs that we found along the way, aside from the hard data. This was just one actually pretty recent story, but I just felt like it really illustrated some of the motivation that we had. This was a woman who gave birth during Hurricane Gustav, which was 2008. She said she never imagined that her baby would come into the world amid falling pieces of ceiling and the creaking of glass, threatening to burst due to the hurricane. This is another one that we found also this year, Hurricane Ike. We found that at this one instance, a psychiatrist happened to be on hand and available to assist in a delivery in a shelter bathroom. He hadn't seen or helped with a birth in about 20 years. It's a good thing babies kind of deliver themselves most of the time. So in thinking about a controlled situation, which with disasters, it's definitely not a controlled situation, but in thinking of shelter planning, things that we can control, we asked the question, what might a useful toolkit contain? What might have helped this psychiatrist who had been kind of out of the birth loop for 20 years? And what we decided is we needed to improve communication among planners and people involved in the policies and planning of these shelters, as well as consumers. And we wanted to do anything that we could think of to prevent any excess mortality among our target population. We know there's an established need for appropriate planning materials for various public health crises, and that's where we started getting slowed down, because we can't apply what might be helpful in a hurricane necessarily to an earthquake or a tsunami or mass wildfires or a pandemic. The inputs tend to change, but there's some common threads, and what we wanted to do was try to come up with some educational items, checklists, and some key recommendations that would be helpful for an all-hazards preparedness. Among disaster planning groups, there is a need for guidance of evidence-based care for this population. Within Florida, for example, shelter supplies and staff qualifications vary pretty widely. So there's a need for specific guidance, which can be used by many different disciplines. Pregnant women are not candidates for special needs shelters in Florida. Our special needs shelters are staffed by medical workers and public health workers. But just because a woman is pregnant doesn't mean that she qualifies for our shelter. As I mentioned earlier, pregnant women are often left to plan with their provider and just report to the hospital in their last weeks of gestation for the storm. This may be, you know, fine for a mother with no other children to care for, or for who's had consistent prenatal care and actually gets that message that that's what she's supposed to do, or if she even has transportation to a hospital, or if she even has a hospital picked yet. In our case, a lot of our Medicaid recipients don't always know which hospital they'll be asked to go to until towards the end. So for many women, what's going to happen is they're going to show up in the general shelters. And this is what's been fairly consistent throughout the hurricane belt. And most general shelters are staffed by community volunteers, such as Red Cross workers. So one of the tangibles that we came up with was a toolkit, but an actual toolkit, not just a stack of paper. What we built, and this is the scale is going to be hard to tell, but it's about 8 inches by 6 inches cubed. And we put together some items based on what was listed in the White Ribbon Alliance for Safe Motherhood. They came out with a document called the Women and Infant Service Package. The items we packaged according to need, and being a veteran midwifery assistant, I could pack these according to what you're going to use first, knowing that people in the general shelters may have never seen a birth, let alone assisted at one, or know what some of these items are going to be used for. What we put in there was an underpad. A lot of these items are just for basic, creating a clean space for the mother. This is not for anything fancy or medically oriented. Gloves, sterile gauze, a cord clamp for the umbilical cord, a disposable scalpel to cut the umbilical cord, a baby blanket and hat to keep the infant warm, feminine hygiene pads, and a sealable bag, and that would be for the placenta, and then which would also then fit back in the cube for hygiene, especially if we're talking about a shelter in which people will be there for days on end. You're not going to have a place to store that. We also included in the top portion of the box there, you can see some paper. That's the American College of Nurse Midwives paper called Giving Birth in Place, A Guide to Emergency Childbirth. It's a wonderful document. It's written very simply for the layperson, and it's step-by-step with drawings. So we really couldn't find a better document to use to put there for the person, because it's got pictures. If they don't have time to read anything, they can at least go by the photographs. There's also a portable record, very small. It's in a waterproof slide, and it's got a mother and baby record, so that if it is utilized, there is something that can be written on for the mother to have some type of portable record of the birth. And then because we packaged these for our local area, we also put some local information in there as well on resources for the family. So what we consider some of our accomplishments with this toolkit is that we did distribute 10 of them throughout emergency shelters in the Florida Keys, which is 135 miles long, if you're not familiar with my chain of islands. It goes from Key West to Key Largo, and we have several hurricane and emergency shelters throughout the islands. We also distributed them throughout the Miami-Dade County area, which is very large, but we did just pick a few shelters in the southern portion of Miami-Dade County. And we gave a brief in-service on the contents of the toolkit, the importance of its use, and an overview of what we were doing as far as our project. We kept the in-service very brief because, again, most of those who are in charge of shelter operations are not medical people. They're equipped to deal with emergency planning and logistics. They don't necessarily have a health background. And most of the people we found were also men who are not always comfortable in talking about birth management. So we did keep the description and the overview fairly brief. These kits were disseminated at the beginning of our Atlantic hurricane season, which was June of this year. We did not get any feedback that any were used, thank goodness, but we did get feedback and thank yous from many of the shelter operators, thinking it was such a great idea and why hadn't anyone thought of it before, which was great but also a little concerning. So some of our other activities were ongoing and they probably will continue, such as being advocates for this topic and trying to assist in bringing the topic to the forefront of both planning and policy. Two of our team members, myself included, volunteered and were drafted onto our state strategic emergency planning committees, and we were on two different committees, which was great. I was on the community team and she was on a children's medical team, and we both brought our idea about this toolkit and trying to integrate more program planning and policy planning into the state strategic plan with regards to this population. And I'm sorry to say we were both not excited about the responses we got. Numerous times what I heard was, the doctors tell them what they need to know during emergency planning. And really we couldn't find a way to convince them otherwise, and because of the enormous topics that needed to be tackled during the strategic planning in Florida. We really felt like we had such a tiny slice of concern, such a small population, which of course was extraordinarily important to us because it was our project, but overall, such an overwhelming task of coming up with a state emergency plan that we really felt like it was definitely not in the forefront or anywhere near the top of the list. But that's okay, we're gonna keep trying. And I'm still on the team, so they're going to have to hear it every time we have a meeting. We did write several articles, and we felt like that was definitely an accomplishment. Several publications, and you can see them listed here. And we do have plans, again, to formally publish our focus group data, hopefully sometime in early 2009. So our focus group accomplishments, again, that was last, ideally probably should have been first, but that's okay, it'll all come together. With our focus group, the facilitation guide that I wrote consisted of about 25 questions addressing perceptions. We really wanted to know, what do these mothers feel about disaster preparedness? What do they think is important to them as the leader of their family? We wanted to know about their disaster preparedness, what they feel about disaster response, and even evacuation. We held our focus group in the Florida Keys. We solicited 10 mothers, English speaking, because I only speak English, with a child under the age of 3 in the home, or pregnant. Those were the qualifications. We ended up having the 10 women that we looked for. None of them actually were pregnant at the time. 7 were still breastfeeding, and all had a child under the age of 3, and many had more than one child in the home over the age of 3. The twist on this process, there's always something fun in the Florida Keys, was that on the eve of my long-term planned focus group, we were going to be facing Keys-wide evacuation the next morning for Hurricane Ike. At that time, Ike was predicted to hit the middle of the Keys. If you're familiar with the Florida Keys, it was going to hit the 7-mile bridge in Marathon, which is smack dab in the middle. So I was, needless to say, shocked that the 10 women that signed up actually showed up to the focus group. And we ended up gathering quite a bit of data from them on our questions, although I would say it did not go, I didn't get the answers that I would have predicted, but I feel like it was probably biased because of the media hysteria at the time and the fact that the cars were already stacking up on the highway to evacuate the Keys. So although we didn't get exactly what we thought we'd get, we do feel that there was quite a bit of relevant data and responses with what we got. And so we'll definitely be able to utilize that information. Some of the themes that have emerged from the focus group data was that these families have their own rules, family rules, I call them, for evacuating, such as, we'll leave if the wind speed is this, and the category is that, and the predicted surge is this. And it may or may not have had any correlation to what was actually being recommended at the time. Most considered themselves prepared. They felt they were all very well prepared. They were all very, though, distracted just by daily life. They considered it a hardship to evacuate to hotels. And the reason they choose hotels is that most felt that shelters are definitely not family friendly. And many we found looked to very unlikely places for sources of information. And I referenced that a couple of slides ago. And when asking, where do you turn for your sources of information during this period of evacuation? We didn't hear Department of Health or the Weather Channel, or we didn't hear what we expected to hear. What we consistently heard was Winn-Dixie and Publix. They're grocery stores in our community, which the grocery stores would probably be thrilled to hear. But we were very surprised that that was what they considered their frontline source for information. And when questioning them a little bit more, what they found was, well, they all have to go and gather their emergency supplies. And these grocery stores are happy to throw out coupons and things for the things that they think you need. So they use that as their guide. Many of them, we were very shocked to hear that that's where they're getting their information, was the grocery stores. So that'll help us with some of our planning in the future. And again, the APHA survey of families that I referenced from 2007 showed that while mothers of young children are slightly more likely than the public to identify a public health crisis as on the top of their list of concerns, only about 18% say that they think it's likely to actually affect their family. 74% of mothers believed that it's somewhat unlikely that it would even happen in the next year or two. And even on the eve of a hurricane evacuation, we could see some similarities even with our responses from the women that attended our group. So some of our conclusions. Overall, we felt as though there was just simply too much to accomplish in too short of time. We did work on a one-year project, and again, because we were a multidisciplinary team and we were all from different agencies, we do not work together in the same office. This was not part of our day-to-day work. This was something we all felt very passionate about. So we were definitely limited in continuing this project. We did find success with having a focus group. We feel our toolkit was well received at the community shelters, and we do feel that that toolkit has a really strong potential for replication. We do have plans to further evaluate our toolkit, especially if anyone uses it, and monitor usage. We'll check on that throughout hurricane season. We do feel reaching consumers and health professionals should be a very important thing to consider for a longer project time. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you. Any questions? I'm happy to turn it over to the New Mexico team. Oh, question? Yes, ma'am.
What was the name of the publication that you put
in? The publication in the top of our toolkit is the American College of Nurse Midwives, ACNM's, Giving Birth in Place, a guide to emergency childbirth. And we scaled the scale down and made it into a booklet format that fit very nicely in the roof of our little kit. Yes? We have very few home births in our region. We don't have any practicing midwives in in the Florida Keys. We have a lot of home birth midwives in Miami-Dade, and a few of them will venture down to the Keys. But it would be the national average is about 1 to 2% for out-of-hospital birth, and we're less than 1%. So it's a very small number of women. Any other questions? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lee Mason, and Mona and I are going to be kind of stepping back and forth throughout this presentation. Did you want to start with this?
Yeah, of course. Can everybody hear me? Apologize, I'm losing my voice of all times to lose it. Well, good afternoon. I'm so grateful that you guys are here to hear a presentation. My name is Ramon Ayazi. I am from Arizona, but attended the University of Mexico and got my degree in health education. And I am a member of the Navajo tribe. I grew up on the Navajo reservation, mainly in the Arizona area, and came to University of Mexico because of education and to get a better job. And I've lived in Albuquerque, have made Albuquerque my home. So usually when we introduce ourselves, we, you know, tell where we're from and where our families are from. And I am was going to go through my clans, but the more I think about it, the harder for me it's going to talk. So I'm going to save my voice. But I'm very happy to be here. And Lee and I actually are colleagues working on two different realms of Albuquerque and two different collaborative groups. So I'm going to have Lee introduce or talk about other team members who could not make it to the Institute. So,
thank you. So my name again is Lee Mason, and I coordinate a community health council in Bernalillo County, which is where Albuquerque is. And it comes from the Maternal and Child Health Act in our state. So our route and our health planning activities really come from maternal and child health. Our other team members, Roxanne Spruce Bly, who was had to leave the Institute in the middle, but really brought a lot of expertise to our team. And Sarah Couch, who is an incredible advocate for behavioral health and people getting their needs met of all types. So what we're going to end up doing a lot of is laying some context for what's happening in New Mexico, specifically Bernalillo County, where Albuquerque is, around access to health care for Native Americans living off the reservation. And as Mona mentioned, we are part of many different collaboratives, and there's many partnerships and individuals that have been doing all of this work. And so when I lay the groundwork for the history and talk about the activities, in no sense are we responsible for those activities fully at all. But there's a lot of really great work happening and incredible partnerships and wonderful people. And it's a beautiful place, as you can see. So, Mona?
Okay. I'm going to briefly give a history of the city of Albuquerque. Like Lee was saying, it is located in Bernalillo County. And here's some information that we like to share with you about Albuquerque itself. It's a majority-minority state where it's a very diverse state filled with 30% of New Mexican, nearly 2 million residents, Hispanic 44%, American Indians 5%, Black 3%, and Asian 2%. And when Lee was talking about different collaborative and partnership, these are the people we do work with in the community. And so the city of Albuquerque is the largest city located in Bernalillo County. It's centralized pretty much in the middle of the state compared to where our capital is located, which is north Santa Fe, which is north of Albuquerque.
So the state of New Mexico faces many challenges. As you can see, 22% of our children are living below the federal poverty level, which is not nearly enough to live on. I think people suggest that 200% of the poverty level would be maybe appropriate for a family to live on. So 46% of our children are living at the 200% of the poverty level or below. And when you look at the American Indian population, 41% of the children are below 100% of the federal poverty level. Some other disparities here: American Indian, Alaska Native, only 57% of the mothers are receiving prenatal care in the first trimester, which is lower than any other group in the state. The teen birth rates are quite a bit higher than most race ethnicities in the state as well, just second to Hispanic Latina. And the infant mortality rates are also quite a bit higher, so we're seeing huge disparities in our state. I'm going to let Mona talk about this.
So what we like to do next is go ahead and give you some terms that we use during this project. We have noticed that a lot of times people, when they pertain to Native Americans who live outside their reservation or pueblos, they're known as urban Indians. And so the term urban Indian actually came from the federal government, and it's used to determine eligibility for certain programs. I myself am Native American, and I am federally recognized with the Navajo tribe, meaning that in order to be federally recognized, you're given a secondary number, which is a census number. And I remember as a kid, I was taught not only to, you know your social security number, but also know your census number, because it's a number that I will be needing to get funding of any type, whether it's through school or even healthcare. Off-reservation is a term defined by our team here to describe any Native American living off the reservation. And these are just two distinctive terms that we want to clarify, because between both terms, a Native American who lives off their reservation doesn't necessarily live in the urban area. New Mexico, of course, Albuquerque is the majority city. There are people who live on the outskirts, and they can live in small towns. Okay. And we do have a map here of our state, and this is a very good map. I'm not sure if you can read it from there. But the map shows all the different pueblos and reservations located in the state of New Mexico. The Navajo Reservation, majority of it is in Arizona, but there's a small portion of it in New Mexico. And the little dark brown spots on there are bands of Navajo tribes that are not connected to the reservation, but they are recognized federally as a small piece of the Navajo Reservation. And, of course, the pueblos are located in the outskirts of Albuquerque, outskirts of Santa Fe and Taos area. So we just wanted to show this to you all, because as you can see from here, a lot of the pueblos or Native Americans have to travel into bigger cities or the bigger towns to get health care, whether their pueblo reservation has a health care facility in their town, in their villages, to get specialty services or any type of certain services, they have to travel to get health care. A great example of this is the Mescalero Apache and how far they have to travel. For instance, a cancer patient will need to go to either Las Cruces, which is south, below right there, or go to Texas to receive any type of cancer care, or come up to Albuquerque. So a drive from the Mescalero Apache to Albuquerque, New Mexico, is probably a good 2 to 3 hour drive. So typical person will need to not only think about when to get their appointment, but they also had to think about gas prices these days, who's going to take them, and if they are the head of their household, they have to consider who's going to take care of the family while I'm gone, and how long is this going to take. So more into consideration about health care and what off-reservation people, or whether or not off-reservation, or people who live on their reservation, where they have to go for their health care. So Native Americans, off-reservation Native Americans, lack the family, tribal, and social support that are offered by living on the reservation. Like I was saying, I grew up on the reservation, and not realizing how much health care was such an issue, because as a child, you're not considering those issues. But, you know, for me, when I got sick, the Indian Health Service was right there. Of course, the waiting was longer, but I got treated. I had better care because both my family, my mom and dad, are teachers. So there's that part of getting care through under their health insurance. But once I left the reservation and went to Albuquerque to go to school, it was harder for me to establish health care with the Indian Health Services in Albuquerque. And mainly because of just trying to get documentation within the services. I didn't live near, I wasn't considered a resident of Albuquerque. So, and that's how the Indian Health Service recognized me. So access to health care is more of a struggle for off-reservation Native Americans because of Indian Health Service's funded streams and other funding and culture factors. So again, with Indian Health Services, the government funds each facility pertaining to how many people live in that area. But then again, it's a process to be residing in certain towns and cities. So here are a few important points that we want to mention to you all. Tribes are considered sovereign nations. Federal trust responsibly developed through treaties, legal cases, and policies, which obligates the federal government to provide health care to all American Indians, among other things. So the treaties that were created over 100 years ago between each federally recognized tribe, that's what sovereign nations use to uphold the government with the, not necessarily responsibility, but what they were told, what they said they would go ahead and give to each federal tribe. Most federal health care dollars are distributed through tribes. So many urban Indians must return to their reservation or villages to receive health care. And with that, because they don't see Albuquerque as a reservation or its own little pueblo area, a lot of Native Americans have to travel home, meaning they have to drive back an hour and a half or 2 hours back to just, you know, get medication covered or any type of not preventive health care, but any type of treatment. Indian healthcare programs are discretionary and funded at the will of Congress, and the federal government spends about $3,945 per capita for federal prisoners and just $2,130 per capita for Native Americans. And just the last point itself, we just wanted to put that number in there because even though that Native Americans do get funding for healthcare, there is a difference in how much is spent. So Native Americans, even though they go to their facilities to get treatment, the funding is not quite there. There's less physicians and nurses who are available for the in each facility. I love this picture. It's President Nixon. In 1970, President Nixon made a statement regarding Native American affairs. And there's a quote from Nixon. It says, "The government has agreed to provide community services such as health, education, and public safety services, which would presumably allow Indian communities to enjoy a standard of living comparable to that of other Americans." So President Nixon recognized this and realized that we need, you know, for Native Americans, that we need to uphold the treaties and encourage what, you know, do what we can for Indian health services or any type of health care for Native Americans. The highest percentage of Native Americans of any American city is located in Albuquerque. The third highest raw number of Native Americans in any American city. 46,883 individuals representing over 407 tribes. And I'm sorry, I'm reading this information off regarding just the city of Albuquerque itself. It's not talking about the whole state. Even though the map I showed earlier was showing all the different pueblos and the reservations in the state of New Mexico, there are over 400 recognized tribes that live in the state of New Mexico. So Albuquerque makes up 13% of the state's uninsured population, while only 10% of the population as a whole. And here's just some health status regarding the health issues that Native Americans deal with. Diabetes, compared to the United States of all races, is almost five times higher for Native Americans.
And this was actually that population living off of the reservation.
Okay.
In Albuquerque.
Sorry. I can mention that. And then the other one is talking about the liver disease. That it's three times higher compared to all other races in the state of or in the United States. So at the bottom we put down here, it's difficult to find accurate data relate to this population. And we realized it was a little difficult to find because in the state of New Mexico, a lot of the Native people have Hispanic last names. For instance, you can meet someone who has the last name Martinez, but they could be from Santa Clara Pueblo. But when they go into a healthcare facility and they do the information to take down for a patient and they see you have a last name Martinez, the assumption is that they must come from a Hispanic background. So there was things like that we had to consider. So there's not a lot of accurate data available for the state of New Mexico pertaining to off-reservation Native Americans. Health access situation. In Albuquerque, they have the Indian Health Center, which is funded by Indian Health Services. And it closed down as an urgent care facility in 2005. And of course, like we were sharing before, a lot of the health care is funded federally by the government. So a lot of facilities, when funding was cut, the bigger facilities first started as hospitals, turned into urgent care, and then now are clinics, small clinics that run from 8 to 5. And these are facilities that are supposed to support off-reservation health care. So care primarily is received through the University of New Mexico Hospital, which is right next to the Indian Health Services. And I'm going to have Lee share a little bit more about that.
So University of New Mexico Hospital, as you saw, is the only public hospital in the state, and the origins of that hospital were that it was originally called the Bernalillo County Indian Hospital, and in 52 there was a contract where they basically obligated themselves to provide health care free of charge to Native Americans, and also that the federal government was required to reimburse the hospital for that. And it's now a teaching hospital and the only level one trauma center in the state, and so it really gets a lot of use and a lot of uncompensated care from all over the state, people coming in from all over different counties. So they see about 12 to 15,000 Native Americans every year, and which is only about 6 to 8% of their population. And we saw that there's more like 40,000 Native Americans living in Bernalillo County. And the data that we've been able to get from UNMH shows that when these individuals are enrolled in the UNM Care Program, which is a program you can get through financial assistance, they go do primary care more instead of going to the emergency room. So there's a lot of history with some community groups that were involved in and the county around the hospital and more accountability for these funds and upholding the contract. So the governor held a summit in 2005 based on some of the community groups in the county demanding this accountability. And there were a lot of recommendations that came out of it related to Native American healthcare access. And I just have to say the hospital has been very good about being responsive to these demands. There's still lots of work to be done, but they formed an Office of Community Affairs and a Community Advisory Council to the Vice President of the Health Science Center and has really developed a conduit for us to make a lot of change in the community. So some of the other outcomes from the summit were additional staff hired, a liaison at the Indian Health Service, because Mona says, you know, they're right next to each other, but that's not to say that they're connected or that they understand each other's policies very well or that they really connect their systems well. And they've expanded contracts with some of our other clinics, like the First Choice and First Nations. So another funding stream that goes to the hospital that our council and most of the members of our team have been working on is our mill levy, which comes from the property taxes in the county. And so the hospital gets about $800 million a year, and it's primarily supposed to be for indigent care. And we spent a lot of time working with the hospital and the county leadership and community leaders, and through a miracle, the hospital has agreed to give 1% of that money to a community navigators program, because we recognize that community health workers or community health representatives can really connect people to the needed social services and health services. So out of that, this Pathways group has been formed, and we're working on, you know, identifying the different pathways that lead to a better health outcome. Like if you want to reduce, if you want to help people with diabetes, it's not going to happen if they don't have a home or access to healthy food. So working with medical professionals and trying to help them understand the role of that and that health outcome has been a challenge, but we're really excited about what's happening there. So one of our activities through the Institute, we co-hosted a community forum with that Office of Community Affairs, and out of that came some recommendations to the Vice President of the Health Science Center. And they include, you know, explicit policies related to Native Americans, and as we talked about the difficulty with collecting data, it also includes really explicitly collecting data for that population and sharing it with the community on their access and the payers. And also these groups have really worked to get community members on the clinical operations board of the hospital and other committees that are really setting policy. And that's been huge for this work, is when you have community leaders and community members participating in these policy making boards, you really are going to see change in the community and in policies. And so they're also recommending that Native Americans not be charged co-pays and really start to actually fulfill some of the things that were stated in that 1952 contract. Yes?
So the recommendations were for all
reservation
and
those on the reservation? Yeah, I mean, that we can differentiate between the two as well. So yeah, but ask the question, you know, that instead of assuming or putting down the wrong or not collecting information at all, that we're now at least asking the question and reporting it back to the community. There's been some community forums where we're actually getting good data back to the community and advocates and public health workers about utilization at the hospital and healthcare as well as behavioral health care. We're really trying to recognize behavioral health in the work we do as well. And so that was one of our big activities. We also recognized, you know, if the community members can help get more people signed up for Medicaid, that will help people hopefully access more health care. And so we hosted several PEMOSA determiner trainings, which is the applications assistance, so somebody in the community could sign an individual up for Medicaid. We also had looked at one of our local organizations, NAPR, Native American Professional Parent Resources, I believe, and to help them outreach to their community more. And we initially thought we could work with them and help them with printing or whatever kind of services they needed. And it came to be that they really wanted support with their home visiting program, and that was really where they were reaching their community and making the biggest impact. So we were able to do that. And some of the other work we do, we're really focusing on home visiting as well because of that brain development. You know, when you're in the womb up to age 3, you know, those are the really important years. And so we've been working in Bernalillo County to also try to get nurse family partnership there, which is a great program if you've not heard of it. So I'll close with just some of it feels like it's a lot of struggle and we're making really little changes and a lot of work, but we really have developed some great partnerships with the hospital and other policymakers in the state and in the community. And the community is really coming together. Some of the work that Mona and St. Joseph's is doing in one of our neighborhoods in the community, they're really getting true community involvement and policymakers and really getting policy change to make healthier communities and, you know, down to how do you build a clinic that's accessible to the community? How do you make sure that the bus stop is covered? So when you're waiting at the bus stop, you have shade or, you know, is it inviting? Are you looking at another parking lot or are you feeling welcome to in the clinic? So there's a lot of great work, community members building trust with community leaders and policymakers, and really just working together to recognize that healthcare and senior doctor does not necessarily mean health, and that we have a lot of work to do along the way to better health. And green chili roasting season is just ending in Albuquerque. It's sad, but we welcome you to ask any questions.
Yes.
Off the reservation, they have to go back to
It's Mona, are you comfortable answering?
The way it's funded through the government is that each money, there is money allocated, sorry, there is money allocated for each federally recognized tribe. And so depending on how the tribe runs their reservation or village, sometimes the money is, the tribe will go ahead and figure out where the money will go. Pertaining to healthcare, what they do is the tribe will, or the government will look at how many people are registered with their tribe. And so like when I was talking about a certain census number given, they see how many people are part of that tribe. And so that's how the money is allocated to each facility or reservation. So for instance, great examples myself, I don't go home as often, which is home for me is the Navajo Reservation, because that's where my parents live, my grandparents live, a lot of my family members still live. I see Albuquerque as a place where I live, but home for me is where my mom and dad live. And for me to get health care through any type of Indian health services, I would need to change where I'm registered back at home to Albuquerque, but Albuquerque is not recognized as like a village of any type. So when we talk about off-reservation Native Americans, people who live on the outskirts of Albuquerque, and people move off the reservation for different reasons. And the ones we recognize were because of education. People leave home to go to school where the university is located in the bigger cities. The other thing is employment. It's another big issue. We would need to leave your reservation to get really great employment, a great job. I would move home if they could offer me a job under my degree. Otherwise, I'd just take any job. Those were the main two we recognized. And so when the money is allocated for each tribe figures out where the money is going to go. Navajo Nation is the largest tribe that exists, and that pertains to the number of people who are registered with each tribe. And so the government will go ahead and allocate money to the reservation. And then from there, the Navajo tribal government will figure out where the money will go. So, but with the different pueblos, their money is allocated differently. And I'm not quite sure. They're very different in each village. I'm not sure if I answered your question. Well, because I have a job in Albuquerque, I do have private insurance. So I go through that to get health care pertaining, either going to University Hospital or where my health insurance is accepted. But if I didn't have any type of insurance, I would try to go home as much as I could. And for me, the drive is about 2.5 to 3 hours. And to just make that trip and come back just so, you know, I don't have to get a hospital bill or any type of prescription. Everything's paid for. But, of course, the timing is an issue. The waiting for the doctor, when I can go in, and that's another process itself.
So you could go to IHS, but it's the waits are long, the services are very limited. Only certain tribes can get the more specific services paid through IHS. I mean, it's really complicated. That's why even within the healthcare delivery system, there's confusion between the entities that are providing care and the individuals receiving it. And I mean, it's crazy. We've had these community meetings where we literally had huge sheets of paper up talking about which tribes will receive contract health services. And it's like, well, if you're from here or married to here, to a person from here, you can't. I mean, it's very, very limited and very complicated. And some tribes are managing their own funding, and if you've ever heard of 638, that those tribes can choose to manage their own funding, and others will, IHS will continue to do it. But it's a complex system to understand.
Right, and through this project that we our team worked on, one thing we did learn is instead of creating and looking at the problem and trying to figure out who the stakeholders are, we looked at the people who are already doing the work. Lee mentioned at the beginning, you know, important note is that a lot of this work was being done already, so we found the people who we could partner with and collaborate ideas. So instead of, you know, reinventing the wheel on anything, really, it was just looking at what people were doing. And so one of them was the NAPR. I'm not going to name the whole thing out because it's a long title, but it's a program that is it's a growing program in the state of New Mexico that work with Native Americans, especially the younger generation.